Land. I'm the director of the Southeast Asia project at the Lowy Institute. And it's great to see so many people here early, first thing on a Monday morning. It's a great sign of how much interest there is in Indonesia. And we've got a great morning ahead of us. I'm really grateful to the Australian National University for collaborating with us again, which we've done for quite a few years now, bringing, I would say, the best, some of the best speakers from the big ANU Indonesia Update Conference, which I was at on Friday and Saturday. Very, very interesting, insightful, great speakers. We've today got some of the real veterans of Indonesia academics and Indonesia watchers and some of the up-and-coming stars. It's good to be joined by Nava Nurania at the end from the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict in Jakarta. She's an expert on political Islam and extremism and all the fun stuff like that. I just want to start, Ed, by asking you something about polarization and the characters we're looking at here. I mean, how much is this polarization a function of the fact that we've seen Jokowi and Prabowo face off against each other twice? There was also this personal animus in a way that Prabowo helped create Jokowi as a political figure in Jakarta in 2012. Jokowi betrayed him, I guess, in Prabowo's eyes. So how much is this just the fact that we've had these two guys clashing, and what does that tell us about the future, I guess, where next time with the two-term limit, at least we know that Jokowi can't stand again. Prabowo, I guess, could go for a fifth, would it be, run at the presidency?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I mean, and you can view it in different ways. I think one of the issues here, it's not so much the two personalities that they're facing off again, but we've had two back-to-back one-on-one elections, head-to-head elections. And that tends to sort of make Indonesia's political alignments sort of, you know, bounce down and settle down around this great historic cleavage, which has always characterized Indonesian politics. Because in some, it is true, for example, that Prabowo has a long history going back to the period when he was involved in, when he was the head of Kopassus back in the late Suharto period, of making these sort of opportunistic political alliances with Islamists. So he was known for that right back in the late Suharto period. On the other hand, he is a really unlikely figurehead as the head of an Islamist political coalition, because he himself is not at all personally pious. He's not, I mean, Nava will be able to attest to this better than me, but, you know, in terms of like reading the Quran or leading prayers, you know, in fact, Jokowi is much more adept at that style of sort of personal piety. So I'm sort of torn in thinking about what will happen in the future. One thing that would make political alignments quite different, I think, is if there were a larger number of candidates in the 2024 election. You know, that then you could see quite a rearrangement of political alliances, a new emergence of new sort of cross-cutting cleavages. But my feeling is now that the polarization has reached such a degree that, especially if you get two candidates facing off against each other again, that there will be a tendency for these two great poles in Indonesian politics to line up behind opposing candidates. That even if some of the individual candidates who run forward are not personally particularly committed to either a vision of Islamist or a highly pluralist vision, that the two great sides of Indonesian politics will sort of congregate behind opposing candidates, and that polarization is unfortunately, I think, likely to be here to stay.
Okay. And just on format, I'm going to quiz these guys for about 15 or 20 minutes, then we'll have about 10 or 15 for your questions, so put your thinking caps on. In this question of what's driving the polarization, there's often a debate between, you know, is this a top-down phenomenon, Nava, or bottom-up? And I remember being in Jakarta before sort of the ouster of Ahok and people who were campaigning against him saying, you know, don't worry, we're using these Islamists just to get rid of Ahok, but afterwards, you know, we'll shove them back in the pesantren, it'll all be okay, we've got it under control. That didn't quite happen. And then before this election, you heard the same thing actually from both camps when I was in Indonesia, that the people around Jokowi said, yeah, we're kind of using Maruf Amin in Islam, but don't worry, once elected, Maruf will be kept busy with like religious studies, he won't impact politics. And on the other side too, of course, Prabowo's people said, don't worry, we'll be the first to crush FPI, but we have to win the election. So what's going on here? How much is this a top-down phenomenon, and how much is it really a bottom-up one?
Well, I think while elites agency and elites cues are very important in deepening polarization, however, they don't just, you know, craft these cleavages out of nothing. Because this, as Ed mentioned earlier, there were deep roots of these cleavages between the Islamists and the pluralist Muslims, as which is now best represented by Nahdlatul Ulama, who is behind Joko Widodo, whereas Muhammadiyah, although historically it's it is still a moderate organization, but it's been, especially in the last two elections, the grassroots level of Muhammadiyah has been more decisively on the conservative side. Now, this Islamist pluralist tension, especially between NU and Hizbut Tahrir, on the other hand, has increased since mid-2000s. So this wasn't just, you know, from the 50s and then nothing happened and then it just re-emerged. The new round of this polarization actually has been building up since mid-2000s. Why? Because of Yudhoyono era. He was accommodating the Islamists. He gave several ministerial positions to PKS, for example, and he and also during his government, the Indonesian Ulama Council or MUI, they accepted leaders of Hizbut Tahrir, which is a pro-caliphate nonviolent organization, into the MUI, which is funded by the state. So the influence of Hizbut Tahrir and other Islamist groups have significantly increased since Yudhoyono era because of his accommodationist approach. Now, what this means in the grassroots level at the time is that Hizbut Tahrir became much more confident. So before they got a license for the first time from the government in 2006, before they got a license, in their media they don't use their name HTI, they just use other names, you know. But after that, they spread their media and the Friday newsletters in NU Mosque. They became more open in bringing their flags, so they attended NU Nahdlatul Ulama events with the flags, and so on. So they became much more confident, much more open, and they also claimed that they infiltrated the elites. You know, they claimed that they got support from two ministers from the Yudhoyono cabinet. So all of this was really threatening to both NU and Muhammadiyah, that in 2006-2007, both NU and Muhammadiyah released an official statement to warn. Muhammadiyah was warning PKS against using its facilities, its schools and mosques, infiltrating them, using them for campaign, whereas NU issued a statement against what it called transnational Islam. So this transnational Islam is really interesting because basically NU positioned itself as both the protector of religious plurality and also the republican system, the Unitary Republic of Indonesia, because it defined transnational Islam as a, you know, groups that operate across borders, and it disregards the nation-state system. It is based on the ummah, the global ummah concept, and it has fundamentalist religious view. So since then, NU has been working on cadre development, recruitment, reactivating its grassroots branches and so on, and especially since 2010, because Said Agil became the head of NU, and then his deputy head was Asad Ali from the internet, from the State Intelligence Agency. So, and the State Intelligence Agency has been a long advocate of the danger of transnational Islam. So there's this much closer cooperation between the NU and also the state, which was deepened when Jokowi won as president in 2014, and then endorsing the NU concept of Islam Nusantara, which is great. So basically this group, which, you know, some of us call the militant pluralists, so they want to defend the pluralism of Indonesia, but on the other hand, to some extent, they endorse illiberal means, silencing debates, banning groups arbitrarily. So this is what we're seeing as emerging in Indonesia. And so Prabowo, because of his past history with the Islamist groups, and also Jokowi because of his new relationship with NU and PDIP and NU as well. So this polarization, you know, came even more strongly.
And what about the bottom-up question? So we read a lot about rising conservatism. People say more women wearing the hijab, even niqab. There's also this hijra revivalist sort of movement. Does the data bear out the fact that Indonesian Muslims are becoming more conservative? And what do you think is driving that?
Well, the Islamization argument has been, it's been going on for a while, you know, especially since the Iranian Revolution in 79. So since the 80s, we've seen this, what you call, before PKS became a party, it was Jamaat Tarbiyah, it was spreading in universities. Hizbut Tahrir also started in the 80s through universities. And so this hijra movement that became sort of this new, you know, conservatism becomes a cool thing, which all the pop culture symbols selling, what is it, merchandises on social media with the hijra symbol on it. It's the role. So it, you know, it, the international influence of Islamic revivalism, and then, you know, after Reformasi, because of the new openness, and then the role of social media, and it becomes the fact that Islam in Indonesia nowadays, you know, there's no single Indonesian Islam, and the identity of Muslim becomes more globalized. So now, if you're in the urban areas, a pious Muslim is one that wears particular kinds of hijab, not the short one, or, you know, it's, and then they're pro-Palestine. So there's all this, you know, domestic and international identity of what constitutes Muslims. But it's not necessarily a bad thing. So, I mean, rising conservatism itself is not the problem, but it is when they promote, you know, intolerant attitude and also disregarding the right of minorities. So what we see here is not just conservatism, but the rise of majoritarianism, when these conservative Muslims want special status for Muslims and Islam in the government.
And Ed, you, on this point, looking at how the electoral data reflects people's attitudes to religion, I mean, one of the great paradoxes, I think, is that we haven't seen a rise in electoral support for the Islamic parties. It's sort of capped off at 30%. I think it might even have been marginally down this time on last time. So how are we to understand this phenomenon where there seems to be growing conservatism, growing political Islam, but the Islamic political parties can't increase their vote beyond, you know, a sort of 30% cap, if you like?
Yeah, so one of the features of the contemporary socio-religious polarization, I think, that does, yeah, give us some sort of source of hope, is that it's a polarization that's not really captured in the party system. So it's quite different from the sort of polarization we see in countries like the like Turkey, for example, or even the United States, where partisan identities are really closely aligned with political party organization. And I think that a good part of the answer is in the sort of brief description I gave of the political party system and the nature of Indonesian elections there, which have become really heavily monetized and heavily based around patronage politics. And very often when Indonesian voters make their choices when it comes to supporting a candidate as a representative in their local political parliament, either at the district or provincial level in particular, they're really not making a choice on the basis of the program of that party or the identity of that party, but rather on the basis of what sort of connection, what sort of personal connection do you have with that particular candidate, or what sort of material benefits are delivered to you. So this was really clear to me, for example, when I spent some time in Central Java during the campaign period, and there were I was in particular visiting one area which was had a lot of, most of the voters were either aligned with Nahdlatul Ulama, so the traditionalist NU organization, or they were the so-called Abangan, the sort of syncretist Muslims, very famous in Indonesia's political history, so not at all on the Islamist side of the spectrum. And I spent a bit of time with a candidate who is running for one of the Islamic parties called PAN, which is closely aligned with Muhammadiyya, the modernist Islamic organisation that Nava mentioned. And he said it was in fact possible for them to win votes in these Nahdlatul Ulama and Muhammadiyya and Abangan villages. But the way to do that was not at all to stress their alignment with Prabowo, because those voters didn't like Prabowo. Not at all even really to stress the party label, because everyone knew that was associated with Muhammadiyya, which was an alien socio-religious organisation to those voters. But to stress what they did to those voters on a personal basis. And it happened that the candidate I was meeting was a local contractor, so he spent most of his time going around the villages, re-asphalting village roads, putting up lampposts in these villages and so on. So there is, as you say, it's one of the other paradoxes of Indonesian democracy, that on the one hand, there's this weakness in the party system, which in the long term is a source of fragility for the stability of Indonesian democracy for the reasons I gave before. But on the other hand, it does act as a brake on the degree of socio-religious polarization that we see in the country.
So you could, the road to Islamization in Indonesia is paved with tarmac.
Yeah.
So, Nava, I mean, I know you spent quite a bit of time talking to some of the people in these more sort of extreme groups, sometimes involved in vigilante actions, many of which sort of got behind Prabowo during the campaign. Obviously, since it's happened, we've had this sort of kiss and make up moment between Jokowi and Prabowo on the metro, which is also a chance for Jokowi to show off the MRT project. And now there's talk of Prabowo or his party maybe joining the government. I mean, how do the sort of people you speak to and who really want to see a more political version of Islam at the heart of politics, how do they feel about Prabowo now? And what are they going to do next?
Well, they're completely angry at him. So groups like, you know, the Islamic Defenders Front or FPI, they were really disappointed with Prabowo. Even, I mean, since the beginning, the relationship was really uneasy. The Islamists had a lot of reservation about Prabowo because he's non-practicing Muslim and everything. I mean, at least that's his reputation. But now at the time, they kind of just sort of put up with him because there was no other candidates. They tried to put forth other names such as, you know, the governor of West Nusa Tenggara and Anies Baswedan, the current governor of Jakarta, but you know, none of them got the support of political parties, so they put up with Prabowo. But now it's just they have completely broken away from Prabowo, and at least they're hoping that Anies Baswedan or Sandiaga Uno or both of them will run in 2024.
And if we look ahead to that next election, I mean, do we think that the pluralist coalition, if you like, is strong enough that one candidate will definitely tilt towards that side of things too? Or is this sort of rising majoritarianism the dominant force? So actually, you know, you might see candidates fighting for the sort of majoritarian, sort of Islamic, more traditional sort of bulk of votes. What do you think? Or do you think we will have a similar kind of split where someone goes towards the pluralists and someone goes more towards political Islam?
Either. Okay. Well, I think it depends on a range of factors, you know, who the candidates will be in 2024, which parties, and etc. But I think ultimately, at least at the grassroots level, the polarization is not going away anytime soon. It's been deepened on the pluralist side. You know, the NU, for example, they're going through this new indoctrination program, very intensive, and kind of reviving this NU pride. And now more and more people at the grassroots level, Nahdiyin, who were previously not aware of the difference between Islamists and Nahdlatul Ulama, they're very alert. So, you know, who's collecting the donation in this village? You know, if it's the Islamists, if it's Hizb ut-Tahrir, we have to stop them. So that kind of awareness is already very strong. And the opposite is true for the Islamists, you know. So you see polarization in everyday life, even now at schools, you know, parents who support Prabowo, parents who support Jokowi, or parents who support Hizb ut-Tahrir or not, it's becoming, you know, it's the reality of everyday life, and it's not going to go away. So whoever the candidates will be in 2024, these cleavages are up for grab.
Yes, sir.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, one of the things we know from previous election campaigns, especially one where there's no incumbent running, is that the possible sort of permutations and combinations of nominating coalitions for presidential candidates is very huge, so it's really hard to make any sort of prediction about how the various parties will line up. Sometimes it's hard even to make a prediction 24 hours before the close of nominations, let alone several years in advance. But I think this point that Nava makes about the everyday nature of polarization is really important, and I think the degree of negative partisanship is so strong, I think, now in Indonesia, that the moment that, say, PDIP starts to make clear who its candidate is, there will be a sort of an automatic search for a candidate who will represent the opposing camp. And that will be really hard to avoid unless there's space for a third candidate to emerge and break up that pattern of polarization. And that's actually very difficult with the nature of the rules for nomination as they now stand, which are actually quite restrictive.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to, in a way, the sophistication of Indonesian politics, that one of the first rules of politics is define your opponent before they can define themselves. So, you know, you're naturally not going to come in and look at ways to build a wholesome coalition, but the weakness, and people will obviously see this division from previous elections and think it's an obvious place to go, is to find the other guy as not Islamic enough, not devout enough, or connected to people who aren't.
One other little flashback, I guess, is that SBY, Yudo Yono, was a candidate who could bridge these two camps, right? So the question is, now that the sort of the genie of polarization has not come out of the bag, what's the appropriate metaphor? Escape, come out of the bottle.
Yes.
The question is whether we can put it back in, Indonesia can put it back in. My feeling is it might be really hard to go back to the sort of status quo ante. Yeah.
And especially because the instinct of both sides is just to punish each other. So now Jokowi has declared a policy to, you know, to root out radicals from the government bureaucracy, state universities and enterprises. We don't know how far that's gone, but at least we know that some ministries have implemented this policy. So yeah, the impact will be long lasting.
And before we open up, I just want to ask a historical question, because Indonesia has always interested me as one of the very few majority Muslim countries in the world that's not either a formal sort of Islamic state, it doesn't have, you know, Islam as the sole official religion, but it's also not a secular state either. It's a religious state with multiple religions. And how far do you think the divisions we're seeing now ultimately go back to this contradiction at the heart of, you know, the very foundation of Indonesia as a nearly 90% Muslim country that is supposedly sort of multi-religious? And that was obviously a compromise to avoid Sharia law being brought in 1945. So how much is this just the legacy of this contradiction at the heart of the nation?
I think it partly has to do with that unresolved debate at the, you know, after the independence. But the dynamics also have changed. It hasn't been the same. Sort of, you know, NU in the 60s, or even before in the 50s, NU still supported the idea that at least the foundation of Indonesia state should be Islam, but now it's come to the other side completely. So part of this is attributed to the historical events, but a lot of what happens afterwards, you know, the new expression of Islamist ideology, I think it's changed a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think the continuities are eerie, and you can see them in the voting patterns, for example, that there you can really pretty clearly draw a straight line between the election results of 2019 and those of, 60 years earlier in the 1950s, and that's quite remarkable. It's true that the exact nature of the ideological competition has changed quite a lot, but there are a lot of another of the continuities is that these ideological competitions then get embodied in institutional and patronage competition. So one of the great sort of themes of the 1950s, for example, was that Nahdlatul Ulama, this traditionalist organization, was often favored by Sukarno, was seen as this sort of patronage-hungry organization that established itself through the Ministry of Religion and diverted funds then towards its educational organizations, the Pesantren, and towards the Kiai or the religious scholars who headed them. We see exactly the same pattern happening now, and a lot of the bitterness of the competition between the different Islamic organizations reflects the fact that Nahdlatul Ulama is seen as being sort of as riding high at the moment, of getting all this access to state resources, to benefits, to material benefits of various sorts, whereas other groups feel that they're shut out.
But I think, to what Ed just said, now the debate is not just, you know, between Pancasila or Islamic system, because the Islamists are now also coming up with their own definition of, with their own interpretation of Pancasila. So they said, we're also Pancasilaists, we're also nationalists, but, you know, our Pancasila is better than yours, because in our Pancasila, Muslims reign.
And we've got about 10 minutes now for your questions. So, yeah, if you can just stick your hand up, tell us who you are and keep it to a question, not a statement. That'd be great.
I don't have any affiliation. And my
question... Do you have a name?
Ian Kennedy.
Okay.
What I want to ask is a clarification. With Islam in Indonesia, is it mainly Sunni, or Is it to some extent Sharia? And if one of the things is how important are the external forces, the international, if it's Sharia, is Shia, it might be Iran, and or it might be Wahhabism from. So the importance of those elements on the politics of Indonesia.
One of my favorite questions. You got asked this question a lot. So most Muslims in Indonesia and Southeast Asia are Sunni, but following the Shafi'i school of law. So that's a traditionalist. That's where the traditionalist comes from, because it's Sunni and Shafi'i. So Shia is actually a very small community in Indonesia. The number, the estimate ranges from 500,000 to 4 million. We don't know exactly, because in our census, you know, they don't ask whether you're Sunni or Shia. But the influence of this transnational Islam has been growing strongly. So on the one hand, you know, the Iranian Revolution, when it happened, it had a strong impact on student activists who are fighting against Suharto at the time, because this gave them inspiration that, okay, so in that, you know, these Muslim Islamic forces can defeat authoritarianism. So that was the influence were more political than theological. So we didn't see, you know, much. Some Indonesians converted to Shia because of the Iranian Revolution, but not that much. On the other hand, this rising influence of Iran also prompted the Saudi to spread its Wahhabi's ideology. And so we from the 80s and even before that, they're giving a lot of scholarship to Indonesian students to study in Saudi Arabia. And these people who came back, they established new Salafi schools with some fundings from Saudi. But now, you know, especially after 9/11, the funding from Saudi has become, it's more difficult because of the terrorist financing law. But the Salafist society, the groups in Indonesia, there are many educational foundation, mosques and everything. They've become more independent in terms of financially. So they're having their own businesses. They have a large social media presence. They're also recruiting mostly middle-class Muslims. So it's the urban middle-class Muslim, they're more likely to be Salafist than the rural traditionalists. So the influence of Saudi at this stage is not that much in spread. It's historically strong in spreading Wahhabism.
Thanks, Kian Wong. Thanks, Ed and Nava. I was really curious to find out, given, Nava, you were saying this rising majoritarianism, which in a way threatens and maybe exacerbates the polarization as well, and how Ed was raising the issue of the state in a way using instruments of the state to increase repression of its opponents. How perniciously used is this religious harmony law, which creates what appears to be a majoritarian suppression of the diversity and the sectarian, you know, divisions that are there.
Was it religious harmony law? Is it the law? The
how is being used for the majoritarian?
Right. The Islamists, at least when they were allying with Prabowo, and not anymore now, they were trying to promote this idea that, it's... So when the other side, the nationalists, the pluralists say, you know, we want tolerance, we want pluralism, they say, yeah, we want tolerance, but tolerance where the majority is also tolerated. So that's kind of they have this really unique views of majority-minority relations, because in their view, the majority has been a victim since the independence, because they were not able to create an Islamic state. And even now, the anti-Chinese sentiment also, plays a role in this view that, the majority, the Muslim entrepreneurs, for example, are far, far off, far away from the really wealthy Chinese, some of the Chinese businessmen in Indonesia. So it's, not just religious harmony, but also political rights, economic issues as well.
And do you have a view on the use of the law specifically and how it's being sort of exploited or deployed as a tool of majoritarianism?
Oh, I'm sorry. look, it's not really my area, but yeah. I know one area of particular concern concerns the establishment of minority places of worship in communities that are dominated by a particular group. And the provisions of the law that require, you know, I just can't quote you the particular provisions, but the provisions that require community consent for the establishment of a minority place of worship have been shown to be really problematic time and again right around Indonesia. So it's, I mean, one of the features of Indonesian democracy as well is that there's often a great deal of, there's a great gap between formal rules and regulations and how they're implemented in the ground. And when you get on at the ground level, especially when we look at things like, security, both sort of security in terms of crime prevention, but also the maintenance of social harmony. There's often great leeway given to representatives of local communities, local religious leaders and so on, which in effect leads to a sort of suppression of social diversity in many parts of Indonesia. So, and establishment of minority places of worship, churches, for example, in majority Muslim areas, is often really problematic as a result of that. I don't know if you have anything.
At the subnational level, it's the Sharia by law. Mm-hmm. And also now, because of the rise of, you know, anti-LGBT sentiment, now West Sumatra governor, for example, they issued their own anti-LGBT law, so use it as a tool to raid on, they claim, you know, some salons or nightclubs that are used for so-called LGBT activities. So this kind of, it's not endorsed at nationally, yeah, but at the sub-national level, it really matters.
Yeah, so that's one of the sort of the contradictions in Indonesia at the moment. You have the political victory of the pluralist, and in some ways the pluralist mobilizes these repressive instruments against the majoritarian camp, but that doesn't mean that this sort of slow sort of advance of majoritarianism isn't continuing especially at the grassroots level, right? And that's another sign or another reflection of this incredibly sort of fragmented, decentralized character of both Indonesia's political arrangements, but also the nature of the state itself, right?
I'm Steve Koh. I'm the vice chair of the Chinese Australian Forum, but I was born in Indonesia. As a follow-on from that last question, actually, my question to the panel is, what is your projection of the rise in particular of the identity politics being played out by especially very conservative or fundamentalist Islamic groups centered in Jawa Tengah or in Archipelago? It's very concerning, isn't it? I mean, do you think Jokowi is able to rein that in, or he wasn't doing much in the last term, was he? And it's very disturbing for the minorities like the Chinese and the provincial archipelagos. What's your opinion about that?
Yeah, how concerned should we be?
About Islamization, polarization? I mean,
Anti-Chinese.
Not necessarily, but any minorities like in the provincial archipelagos like Kalimantan or.
Oh, okay. So out in the region. So I mean, I think so. Okay. So the general trend, I think, is concerning. You know, and it's a trend that's been visible for quite some time. And although the government is mobilizing to some degree its repressive apparatus to take aim at some of the Islamists and doing the sort of things that Nava was talking about, for example, beginning to implement purges of the state apparatus at the center, I think it's very hard because of these slow-moving sort of social processes which are going on that Nava also talked about. The rise of an urban Islamic middle class, the hunger amongst many members of that middle class for some sort of spiritual, how would you put this, like easily consumable, media-friendly versions of spiritual solace to accompany all the sort of, you know, the alienation associated with modern life.
Retail Islam.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so there are these very strong pressures that will lead further towards majoritarianism. Now, how that plays out in different parts of the country just really varies, right? So How it gets politicized varies greatly. So, for example, there are parts of Indonesia where ethnic Chinese politicians are now a sort of established feature of local politics, you know, getting elected as members of parliament or even as district heads and so on. But there are other parts of the country where, you know, there is real controversy about participation by ethnic Chinese politicians and religion or ethnicity can get really politicized during electoral contestation. So I think the general trend is one towards Islamization and lowering of social tolerance in general. There's a sort of a fight back against that being launched by the central government, but that has its own risks of political illiberalism. And overall, it's just a really patchy situation. That sounds like I'm avoiding answering the question, doesn't it?
No, I mean, I agree with Ed, but I think there are still some bright spots. So, I mean, you can't, if, you know, on the one hand, you know, if you can't consume in, Islam instantly by just, you know, buying new clothes and then you're suddenly, and then go to Makkah, you're suddenly, you know, very pious Muslim. On the other hand, for the pluralist side, you know, they can't just use the state tools, the state apparatus to silence these Islamists. For example, in the past few days, there was a controversy because in Indonesia, we have this international book fair in Indonesia, and then the committee was going to invite Felix Xiao, who is a book author, a famous author from Hizbut Tahrir, also a famous cleric as well. And so a very senior journalist, Gunawan Muhammad from the pluralist camp, refused to attend the same event because he doesn't want to be, you know, because Hizbut Tahrir is anti-NKRI and this event is funded by the state. So, I mean, you can't keep using the same arguments. It's giving, you know, you can't give platforms to the Islamists without, you know, counter-narratives or counter-identity. And who is now talking no longer just counter-narrative. We want counter-identity. I mean, you can't silence them in public debates. And so far, at least, even though the government already declared Hizbut Tahrir, for example, as a forbidden organization, but they haven't arrested the individuals, so they're still free to roam around. But I mean, I don't know what's the limit of this radical purging, for example, in the government and in private company sector. I think that's what worrying for me. So for the pluralists, they can't take the shortcut way. If the Islamists have been building their schools, all their infrastructure, you know, they have thousands of schools now since the 80s. So the pluralist side, Nahdlatul Ulama also have, you know, wide school networks. So now they have to be, you know, equally patient, just building more base in the urban areas where they're still lacking. So it's, you know, counter ideas with ideas, not with force.
Well, yeah. Please give a round of applause to Ed and Nava for some great talk today.